It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CenturTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, moving right along. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
You guys, I have like a super awesome, cool description of a DARPA challenge I want to tell you.
DARPA challenge?
Yeah. So, you know, DARPA, that's that big old facility, or agency, I should say, in the United States that ends up funding lots of stuff for essentially the Department of Defense.
Uh-huh.
And without DARPA, we wouldn't necessarily have things like autonomous cars that are coming out. Google's autonomous car wouldn't be a thing because a lot of the people who worked on that originally developed autonomous cars as part of a DARPA challenge. So DARPA issues these challenges out to pretty much any entity that can compete in them and says, if you're able to do, you know, this particular task in this particular way with something, then you will be awarded a certain kind of prize. So in this case, the DARPA challenge I wanted to talk about has to do with robotics. They don't all necessarily deal with robotics, but this one specifically does. So here's the challenge. You first have to build a robot that is capable of moving around and sensing an environment, be able to leave a building, climb down a set of stairs, go to a golf cart, get in the golf cart, and drive the golf cart to a different location in dynamic situations. So there could be traffic, there could be pedestrians.
And the golfers.
Yeah, the robot has to be able to navigate around these things without causing harm to itself or others, you know, three laws. And then it gets to a new location, gets out of the golf cart, goes into another building, climbs a different set of stairs, then has to break through a wall and then find a fire hose, pick it up, and point it at a target. Now,
Does it have to turn the fire hose on?
Not necessarily. At least that's not how it was described to me. So the whole point of the exercise is to really push the limits of what we can do in robotics. I mean, that's the case with all the DARPA challenges. It's meant to be something that really makes engineers and scientists work extra hard in order to achieve it, because these are extraordinarily difficult things to ask of anyone,
but also very useful and extraordinarily difficult. Absolutely. Like, I couldn't do that.
Right.
Like, I mean, the Kool-Aid man would be able to break through the wall part, but not,
right.
I mean, but the rest could be a challenge.
Right.
This is
exactly
hard.
Yeah. Yeah. It did not say that the robot had to yell out, "Oh yeah," after coming through the wall. So
I think it's the only obvious.
I think you'd kind of have to have it do that. But, so in any way, the winning group, I think, gets like $2 million if they win this, which in the grand scheme of things, when you think about how much work goes into making something like this happen, is probably getting paid about the, you know, it's probably maybe even taking a loss. Who knows? But the idea is that you'd have to have a robot that's strong enough to break through a wall. It would have to be able to maintain its balance by going up and down stairs. It would have to be able to be environmentally aware. So it'd have to be able to navigate around obstacles, have to be able to actually navigate, period. It'd have to have some form of maps inside of it, or GPS, so that it could know how to get from location A to location B. There are a lot of different elements to this challenge, and none of them are easy.
I have a question. Does it have to be a two-legged robot, or can it be a six-legged robot that goes downstairs and drives a golf cart?
It does not have to be a two-legged robot. A lot of the teams are focusing on making a human-like robot, because a lot of the stuff we happen to operate, say, like golf carts, happens to be made for human-shaped things.
And not six-legged insect bots.
But there's nothing specific from what I understand, because I actually asked that same question.
Nice.
I said, does it have to be like a bipedal robot? And I was told, no, it doesn't have to be. In fact, if you can figure out a way of engineering around that, then you could do that. And in fact, that's kind of what leads me up to this topic I wanted to talk about, is just the idea of how robots get around places. I mean, that's just one aspect of all the difficult things we just mentioned, but it's still all on its own hugely challenging.
Yeah, the idea is robot locomotion. Locomotion is different from just motion. So robot motion is something we've been working on for a long time, making an arm that welds a car door.
Right.
Or a Cartesian robot that moves over something moving along under it on a conveyor belt, and it can punch holes in it or something like that.
Right, right.
But locomotion is talking about getting from one place to another, which is not necessarily as easy as it sounds.
Right. And in fact, if you look at a lot of the early robots used in manufacturing, those were robots that were not meant to move.
No.
They weighed tons and tons, and you set them down. And in fact, not only were they not meant to move, they were not meant to be near people. Like,
yeah.
Human interaction was not a thing, because these were giant, powerful machines that could do serious injury to someone if they got in the way. But now we're talking about a world where our robots are coming into closer contact with us, and also that we want to send off to other places. How do we make sure they can get around?
Right. And so robot locomotion is a big topic, and I think we could do a bunch of episodes about locomotion generally. I think today it would be cool to focus on one really specific challenge, and maybe one of the hardest jobs in robot locomotion, which is getting around on other planets.
Right. So we're talking about rovers here, the idea of some sort of robotic entity that can move around on the surface of a planet, and it's receiving commands all the way back here from Earth. In some cases, in pretty much all cases, you have to have a lot of autonomy built into the robot, because from the time it comes into contact with something to the time when someone can react to it and send a message back to the time when it can then react to the message can be half an hour. Like in the case of Mars, I think it's something like 14 minutes each way.
Well, that is one potential time, because
right, Earth
because
and Mars
orbits,
are never, yeah, Earth right. and Mars are not always at the exact same distance from each other.
14 minutes, that's either the maximum or the minimum or the average.
Wow, Joe, that's
that number occurred for a reason.
Covering all the bases. You know, that was specifically when the Curiosity rover was landing on Mars.
Yeah.
At that point, Earth and Mars were no longer at their closest points. It's one of those things, because the planets are always in motion. You have to plan out these launches very specifically in order to conserve as much fuel as possible, because as we know, fuel adds weight. But all of that aside, you know, even getting all of those challenges, which we could do a full episode just on the challenges of getting the Curiosity rover to Mars, there's still the challenges of how does the rover move around once it lands on the planet.
Right. So I think today we should just talk about a few different potential designs for how rovers get around. And before that, maybe we should talk about some general concerns. By no means is this list exhaustive, because there are tons of concerns that go into designing a robot
that needs to move around. But these are some good basic groups, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So number one, I think, is something that you might not think is important when it comes to somebody like NASA that has government funding. But actually, it's very important even to space exploration, which is just cost and ease of design.
Specifically to space exploration, which we've seen receive budget cuts several times over the last few decades, really.
Right. So pretty much all engineers have to consider this. You know, what are the cost of the things you're using, the cost of testing them, the cost of designing them, and how feasible is it to make this thing work in time for launch?
Right.
There's also issues of mobility, like how fast can it go? How deftly can it move around?
Right.
Like its turning radius and things like that.
Sure.
There's stability, which you could address two ways. One, you could make a robot that is very resilient to falling over, or resilient as in it doesn't fall over, or you could make one that doesn't mind falling over.
Yeah, this makes me think of those remote-controlled cars that they that came out when I was a kid. These that were designed in such a way that if the car flipped over, you could continue controlling it. It would just mean that some of your controls would be reversed, because the car itself was designed so that the wheels were a greater diameter than the
body.
Height of the car. Yeah,
right.
Sure.
Yeah. So. And I've seen some like military industrial robots that operated on a similarly small scale.
Right.
In a similar way. And note here that making instrumentation attached to your robot that doesn't mind getting tumbled all around might be one of the trickier parts of this particular hoopla.
Yeah, sure. You might be able to get a robot to land on the planet and roll around a lot, but if you are designing a robot that can do that on its back, it probably doesn't have a lot of delicate equipment on it.
Yeah. So there's that. There's also the integrity of the robot as a structural unit. You don't want it to get stuck or to get broken easily.
Sure.
There's energy efficiency, which is a big deal when you're shooting something far away from the Earth. You can't plug it in to recharge it.
Yeah, we haven't got a Tesla supercharged station on the Martian soil yet. And I don't think they have any plans in the near future to address that.
No, so you either need like
get on that, Elon Musk.
Yeah, no, really. Come on, you're with SpaceX, for goodness sakes.
You need like a protected mobile power source that's going to last a long time, like Curiosity's little nuclear ditty. Or you need something like solar panels to continuously absorb power from the sun. But
even
with something like solar panels on Mars, you've got some problems, because solar panels, number one, are not that efficient. You're not going to be generating a whole lot of useful power. That's limited. Number two, they can get stuck out of alignment with the sun, or they can become covered in dust.
They're big and delicate and pretty clumsy.
You could even have your robot in a region of the planet where, as it goes through its orbit, it is no longer, you know, getting that much sunlight at all, which is what happened to a previous Martian rover that is sadly no longer with us.
A bonus of rover design is that these things should ideally move pretty slow in general. Like the Curiosity, for example, can go about 4 centimeters per second. That's like 0.13 feet per second. And that low speed helps you maximize the engine's output for strength.
Yeah, it's like
motor,
torque.
At any
rate.
Yeah,
you can really, you can get a lot more torque there than and that's what you're concerned with, because you may be climbing an incline or going over a rock, and that's when you need a lot of torque, but you don't necessarily need to go fast. It's not like, as far as we know, no Martians have been chasing any of these. It's not like this rover needs to go 0.14 feet per second or it'll explode.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing about the
also,
rovers.
Also, Keanu Reeves is luckily not on Mars, so that cuts
down. What do you
mean,
luckily?
That cuts down on a lot of scientific problems, from what I understand.
I'm campaigning hard to get Keanu Reeves sent to Mars.
Oh, I've actually started a Kickstarter.
Yeah.
I reach funding soon.
But then there's also just the concern of how do you get the rover to its destination?
Which is a much bigger problem than most people would probably realize. Like, you can't just put an RC car in a cannon and shoot it at Mars.
No.
Well, you can, but it's not going to
make it there.
It has to be something that you can put into a space vehicle.
Right.
And something that you can deposit on the foreign surface, whether it's, you know, Mars or the moon or wherever you want to take it, mm-hmm. without damaging the thing so that it can move around. This is not easy at all.
Again, the Curiosity rover really proved that. It was one of those plans when I first heard it, I thought, well, that's crazy.
Yeah, it had some crazy rocket parachute thing.
Yeah, well, because the Martian atmosphere is not viscous enough really to have a parachute be very effective. I mean, it was able to slow the descent a little bit, but not like it would here on Earth. And it had to have rockets, retro rockets essentially, to slow its descent, or else it never would have been able to make it down onto the surface safely.
So, but also, I mean, pretty wicked shocks in order to let the wheels support its weight from even the gentle drop.
And so we're talking about, like, again, it was one of those where this whole thing had to happen autonomously, because the rover was going to enter the atmosphere and land on the planet's surface in less time than it would take for it to send a message back to Earth. So when we were waiting to hear about whether or not the Curiosity rover had set down safely, it had actually done that 14 minutes previously. So we found out and we all celebrated, but the actual event had happened 14 minutes earlier. It's pretty incredible stuff when you think about it. And not only that, but you really have to make sure that your design is compact so it can fit within the confines of a spacecraft.
Yeah.
It's not like we have the ability to put any shape of spacecraft up in space. It's all dependent upon the rockets that you use. So you need to make sure that you're really conserving that space. Just like you don't want to have a whole lot of extra weight, or you don't want any extra weight if you can avoid it. Mm-hmm. You don't want to take up too much space either.
Yeah, so I guess we should start with something like the Curiosity rover and the other rovers that we've sent to Mars with the obvious one, wheels. I mean, this is the obvious way to get a machine to move around. And there are pretty good reasons that it's the go-to system for rover locomotion right now.
Yeah, they're simple, for one thing. They're one of the simplest machines that's out there. In fact, it's, you know, you look at the inclined plane, the lever. Well, the wheel and axle's right up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's the simpler you get, the better. I mean, that's one of its greatest strengths, right, is because it's such a simple design, there are fewer parts to break down.
Right.
So that's a big, big advantage.
It's less complicated robotically. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you think about something like a robotic leg, think about all of the different movements and software calculations that have to take place just to move a leg from one place to another.
Yeah, let alone taking into account all the different types of terrain. Wheels work on a lot of different kinds pretty well, especially since we're talking about rolling at a very controlled rate. It's not like we're talking about trying to, you know, do wheelies across the surface of Mars, although that would be awesome. So we're not worried so much about speed. We're worried more about the efficiency. We're worried about that power. And for a lot of the terrain we're looking at, wheels work just fine.
Yeah, if you're just trying to drive across a pretty flat plane, your wheels are going to be great.
Yeah.
Curiosity actually has some really cool wheels.
Yes, they do.
In particular.
Yes, it does, rather. Yeah, it's got some indentations in its wheels, which allow it, when it rolls over soil, the regolith, it actually leaves behind little patterns. And by maneuvering the robot in very specific ways, engineers on Earth can command the Curiosity rover to roll around in such a way that these little markings, these little raised portions from the indentations in the wheels, end up spelling out Morse code messages.
Huh.
And so they've sent messages, you know, they've left messages for things like, you know, putting in the initials JPL, things like that. So it's cute stuff like that. Although they've also used it in order for the Curiosity rover to leave a mark behind that says, this is your starting point.
So like navigational stuff.
Yeah, it's not just for, you know, it's not
Bunsies,
just not
yeah.
just the equivalent of IBM manipulating individual atoms to spell out its name.
Yeah. Also, I think wheels are generally about as energy efficient as you can get. Now, if you are an engineer or robotics expert who would love to correct me on that, please, I invite that. But it seems that a wheel is peak energy efficiency to me.
It's pretty compact.
Yeah, a wheel turning is a much lower, it's much less energy to turn a wheel than, say, manipulate a robotic limb that might have multiple servos and joints in it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, I'm just thinking about like the different mechanical energy required to, say, ride a bike across a flat plane a certain distance versus running.
You're getting into some gyroscopic elements that don't apply when you're turning the wheel at a speed of 0.13 feet per second. But I understand what you're saying. One of the things about a bicycle is that when you're moving at a certain speed, you have this gyroscopic effect that actually keeps you upright and helps you maintain balance. And that would also, quote unquote, make things easier. So it's a little different. But in general, yes, I agree. There are some disadvantages.
Oh, yeah. Well, for one thing, wheels can get stuck.
Yep.
Especially,
in fact, they have gotten stuck.
Yeah. So in the spring of 2009, the Spirit Rover, which, by the way, I do not want to paint the Spirit Rover as a failure. The Spirit Rover long outlived its planned mission.
Oh, yeah.
And it went all over the place. It did a great job.
And it inspired lots of people. I mean, NASA did a great job with getting the word out to the public about the Spirit, about the Curiosity as well, where it excited a lot of people about the space program.
Which is one reason it was kind of sad when, like I started to say, in the spring of 2009, the Spirit became stuck. It was going across an area called Troy on Mars, and its wheels became stuck in loose soil. And so for a long time after that, basically NASA was just trying to figure out a way to plan an escape action for the vehicle, but it never got out of the loose soil.
They should have launched an enormous wooden horse to land right in front of it they could climb into, and then it would have been fine. I read my history.
Your history, the Iliad, yeah, okay.
So
that's not the only kind of surface that wheels have trouble sometimes with. What else have we got?
Right, you could say, what if you needed to get over a pile of loose rocks? Well, in that case, wheels could have a lot of trouble.
Yeah, or if it's really, really rocky terrain, wheels may not be able to...
may not be large enough to
get over them.
Yeah. What if there's a crack in the ground larger than the diameter of the wheel?
Yeah.
I mean, that's,
yeah, then you just
stuck.
Get stuck. Yeah. Yeah. If the wheel gets to the point where it's no longer making contact with the ground, you could be really seriously stuck. Or, you're just talking about inclines. If the incline is steep enough, the wheel may have to work harder than the machine is capable of generating. They have to generate more power than it's capable of doing. And then you can't go any further. Or if you happen to be descending an incline, you might end up losing control.
Right. But despite these disadvantages, I don't want to give the impression that I think wheels are a thing of the past. I think wheels are awesome, and it's amazing what you can do with wheels and smart engineering. Like the rocker bogey system that they use for the suspension of the drive on the Curiosity rover.
Oh, yeah.
Right. These are the Curiosity. So it's got six wheels, and each can be independently controlled, and each receives torque directly from the engine. The axles for each wheel are also independent. Each is connected to this suspension device. It's sort of like a leg-like device.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've got a lot of maneuverability there. You've got a lot of ability to give yourself the propulsion you need to get around or over obstacles. It's pretty ingenious.
Yeah, there are actually videos online you can go look up that are pretty cool of the JPL researchers trying to design the system, and they're testing it in the lab, driving it over these little humps, and it's the most inspiring crawling over a hump you've ever seen.
At the speed of a few centimeters per second. Yeah.
So those are wheels. Let's talk about legs.
Legs? How come we don't have rovers with legs?
Okay, so legs are great. I love them. Love me my GAMs.
Uh-huh.
They're great. Fantastic.
Well, they're really great for biological organisms like us.
Absolutely. I mean, they let us get around.
Let us get into trees and stuff.
They let us swim.
And out of trees, both.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. They let us climb things. Like, we can climb stairs. We can get over rocks. We can do lots of cool things that are really useful. We can jump. We can hop. It's so nice outside. Sorry, I got a little distracted. But yeah, we were able to use our legs to do a lot of things. They're very versatile is what I'm getting down to.
They're great for all kinds of terrain.
Right. So in that sense, they're fantastic. And so there's a lot of work being done building robotic legs that have a lot of versatility to them. However, that work takes a lot of time because holy cow, is it hard to do?
Yeah, I was just thinking that I can build a wheel and axle with Tinker Toys, but I can't build legs.
Not working ones.
Yeah, no. The whole part where they're incredibly useful is because they have all of these different points of articulation.
Yeah, and those points of articulation give us that freedom exactly so that we're able to tackle various obstacles in different ways. But in order to create a robot that has the same degrees of freedom, you have to build in a lot of different systems for that to work. And then we're not just talking about mechanical systems, which are already, that's complicated enough, right? To build a mechanical leg that can do
that
the
can
things
move like a leg.
Yeah.
Right?
That can move like a leg, that one is not taking crazy amounts of power to operate. And two can still support the weight of the rest of the robot. But then you also have to build in the software systems that you were alluding to earlier, Joe, the software that can control the movements of this leg, that can detect changes in the environment and react to it so that the robot maintains its balance and is able to continue forward. This is not easy to do.
Right. I'd imagine with legs, it's more difficult to program stability.
Yeah.
Like with a wheeled vehicle, it's just got static stability. So you just sit it down somewhere and it's stable. If you have a creature with legs that's going to be lifting legs and stuff like that, it seems like there's more potential for it to fall over.
Yeah,
basically.
You have to shift your weight every single time you take a step, and it's all incredibly automatic to most of us. But I mean, but that's why babies fall down all the time while they're trying to work that thing out, or puppies, or adorable Boston Dynamics robots.
Yeah. So one thing we can probably get out of the way is that bipedal robots that would be, you know, used for space exploration, probably not going to happen anytime soon. There's no reason.
I don't
for
know
it.
Why you'd need that.
No, I mean, the only reason I can argue is that people would probably develop an emotional attachment to such a thing because it resembles us enough. But then we've seen people develop strong emotional attachments to the Spirit and the Curiosity rovers.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not like that's a prerequisite.
No, when I'm imagining a rover with legs, I'm imagining probably a hexapod, like a six-legged rover, kind of like the Curiosity rover has six wheels. And I would imagine that something like that would probably have a more limited and narrow focus of locomotion. Like, it would be something if you wanted to climb a mountain on Mars with a rover.
Right.
That seems like that might be useful for that kind of thing. It's got these billy goat scrabbling legs.
Right.
That like you see on real goats.
Yeah, definitely a special case right there.
Yeah.
Where, because you're talking about a task that is particularly difficult for a wheeled rover, you would need to find something, some alternative, right? And but you wouldn't use that same legged rover to roll across the expanse of Mars because it would be less efficient.
Unless you could attach wheels to the ends of those legs.
So what do you know?
Yeah.
There's actually a cool rover that does just that.
This thing's so creepy.
So this is called the Athlete.
The all-terrain, hex-limbed, extraterrestrial explorer. And this is, it's being billed as a vehicle, which you might want to separate in your mind from
robotic.
Like a totally robotic rover.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, okay, so these things, if you've never seen a picture of them, they look like giant robotic insectoid wheelers, like from Oz.
I was going to make that same comparison, that it was like the wheelers from Return to Oz.
It's because
which,
that's what they look like.
Super and
it's
creepy.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
But yeah, so six articulated legs, each of which ends in a wheel. I mean, really, the wheels are for the general all-purpose getting around, and the legs are for if the thing encounters any kind of difficult terrain.
Yeah.
Extreme terrain, I think, is the official NASA terminology about that.
Yeah, so the wheels can lock into place and act just like feet or hands, essentially. But, yeah, this thing is... It's part spider, part wheeler from Return to Oz, and... all nightmare, in my opinion.
So there's that. And you can see why this would be useful, especially if legs can double as arms and you need to use them for army things.
Now, let's, where's the king keep his armies? In his sleeveys. All right, so moving on. What about this this gecko bot thing I'm seeing here?
It was an interesting thing I saw. This is not for exploring planetary surfaces, but I did see it mentioned in the context of space from the ESA. And basically, it's a crawling robot that makes use of biomimicry of the gecko's gripping fingers.
So they're using like slightly larger versions of movie Spider-Man's ability to climb. They've got these tiny hairs or spines or whatever you want to call them that like dramatically increase its surface area, allowing it to cling to a surface at a microscopic level.
Yeah, if you look at a gecko's little fingertips and you were able to look at them on a nanoscopic level, you would see all these hairs, and those hairs would actually interact with material at an atomic level. So this is a level up from that. We're not talking atomic. We're talking
micro.
Micro level, like molecular maybe, but
not quite molecular.
It's definitely, they're definitely larger than the nano hairs you would find on a gecko's limbs, but they have the same effect. They're enough so that the robot can support its own weight.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the cool thing about these, as this ESA post points out, is that they could work in space, unlike some like sticky adhesives.
Right.
So imagine you want to fly around in your spacecraft or drive around on the surface of Mars with some kind of large vehicle that may require exterior repairs. This could like crawl around on the outside of the hull and do those repairs for you.
Oh, in low gravity, sure.
Right, yeah. And then feed more nightmares. So then we've got Boston Dynamics. Oh, I'm just going to give up. All of these things give me nightmares. No, actually, I love
Boston Dynamics is a weird mix of nightmares and total cuteness.
It's nightmares and dreams at the same time. It's our favorite robotics company that also gives us the supreme willies.
It usually doesn't give me nightmares until I see people kicking it. And then I'm just like, I get upset.
Okay, so Boston Dynamics is another company that has worked with DARPA, as we mentioned earlier. But they've been creating lots of different kinds of robots, especially for military applications, seemingly for like transport. So there's the Big Dog and the Wildcat, and these are four-legged robots that they have programmed to run around or walk around in different kinds of terrain. And these things are really cool because of what they can do in terms of legged locomotion. Mm-hmm. Like they're pretty advanced. One of them, I don't remember which one it was now. Is it the Big Dog that you just alluded to, someone from the company goes up to it and shoves it with his foot.
And it's already walking on a slippery, icy surface.
Yeah, it starts to stumble and scrabble, and just then, like you would imagine an actual animal.
And then it collects itself and continues to move, albeit on this slippery surface. So.
And it does so apologetically, as if to say, please, sir, don't kick me again.
Oh.
I might be anthropomorphizing.
We are all still upset about this video. It has deeply impacted it. If you want to hear a lot more about Boston Dynamics and their robotic animals, we did a podcast and a video both released on February 19th of 2014 called RoboPets and Robot Pets of the Future, respectively. So go check those out if you want to hear a lot more about them.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if robots like this would have such a great use on a foreign planet. Maybe, but I would have a few questions. One of them would be, so if you want to look at the advantages of the stumbling robot that, you know, gets its balance after you've shoved it, I wonder, number one, what use would that be on Mars unless you're expecting something to push it? And then number two,
extra nightmares. Huzzah. Thanks, Joe.
Is something I suspect but don't know for sure. I think when you would design legs for stability, it's important to take into account the force of gravity, which would vary depending on the rover's location. So if you take something that's been designed to stumble and get its balance on Earth, I don't know if that would still work on like a low gravity environment.
You would need to mechanically engineer the legs in such a way so that it could support the weight of the robot in whatever mm-hmm. end environment it was going to operate in. So mm-hmm. Now if it's going into a lower gravity environment, that's actually, you don't have to worry about making them stronger, obviously. Then in software, you would probably have to adjust exactly how much power it would send to all the different servos and motors that are involved in those legs.
I imagine it could be done largely algorithmically, but I that would just be hell on testing.
Yeah, it would be.
I mean, I'm not even sure that would be a problem. It just seems like it might be.
I think the biggest question would be, what would you need that kind of robot to do? And the only thing I could imagine is if you wanted to explore a region of Mars where you knew that the ground was going to be very rocky, very difficult to traverse otherwise, and that you would need this ability for a robot that could steady itself in case it stepped on something that gave way,
mm-hmm.
right? Rather than, say, a wheeled robot that might end up becoming part of a rock slide, maybe a legged robot that could catch itself. But, that's complete just speculation.
Okay, but here's another option. Let's go a little bit back in the wheeled direction. So we've seen there might be some good uses of legs, but it might be a more narrowly focused kind of thing.
Yeah.
What about tank treads, continuous tracked locomotion?
Yeah, the tracks are good for things like, again, navigating really difficult terrain. I mean, that's why we put them on tanks, because tanks would be driving across areas that needed to have a lot of power. So there needed to be a lot of torque there. It also needed to be able to go over difficult areas. So it has some advantages, but those might be outweighed by the disadvantages.
Well, I would imagine that they are better at loose soil.
Like, yes, you wouldn't have to worry as much.
See wheel shit stuck in.
Yeah, so they are better at navigating through that. However, they also require more power. You have a lot more moving parts, so that is already an issue, right? It's not as simple as a wheel and axle. So the more moving parts you have, the more opportunity there is for a mechanical failure,
mm-hmm.
you know. So there's that. There's also the fact that you have usually a track of some sort that could become de-threaded from that. Yeah. And then in that case, you've lost your ability to push yourself forward. And it's just like getting stuck in the loose soil, except in this case, you've just lost the tread. They're able to turn, depending upon the nature of the treads, they're able to turn fairly tightly, but it takes a lot of energy to do it, as opposed to a wheel. So turning anything that's on these track systems is a laborious process, requires a lot of power. And also, if you've designed the treads so that they're really, really grippy, it may not turn so well. Because mm-hmm. turning actually means that you have to create a skid.
Right.
It can't turn like a wheeled thing where you can just start gradually introducing a turn so it starts to curve over to the left or to the right. It has to start skidding itself to the left or right and then continuing forward. It's not this natural kind of smooth curve. And again, if the material that you made the track out of, or if whatever it's traveling on is too grippy, then it can get stuck not being able to turn left or right.
This may just be because of the continuous track vehicles I'm familiar with, like bulldozers and tanks and stuff. But I would also tend to imagine that a design like that is probably heavy.
Yeah,
I'm not an engineering expert with this kind of thing. But I think the answer here is yes, because okay, think about a wheel system. All the mechanics that you need for it are a couple axles, and wheels have a relatively small surface area. Part of the draw of continuous treads is that they have that larger surface area, but that's necessarily more material and therefore more weight. They're also driven by two or more wheels themselves, so you have at least as much interior mechanics as a wheel system. However, I mean, that's the kind of thing that, although this applies to wheels as well, material science is going to help us improve in the future.
So this leads me to a question for you, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
What if we could design a robot that on its own could propel itself without any sort of limbs or wheels? It actually moves itself some other way. So it's not gripping the ground with legs. It's not turning wheels. It's not using tracks. The whole robot itself moves as a unit in some way.
Jonathan, I want you to imagine something.
Paint a picture with your words there, Joe.
Okay. Imagine a big old beach ball.
Okay.
Now imagine it is on a beach, tumbling over the sand blown by the wind.
Okay.
Now imagine it is full of scientific instruments that measure things about the environment.
So far, typical day at the beach.
Now imagine it's on Mars.
Okay, not so typical.
I posed this exact same scenario in a blog post I wrote about something that is actually being designed, the Mars tumbleweed designs. And this is an idea that engineers have been talking about for a long time, the idea of a wind-driven inflatable rover for use on Mars.
It's pretty ingenious because you no longer have to dedicate a huge amount of work to creating a power system that can propel your robot, because the robot's being propelled by whatever wind happens to be present at the place where it's going. You can then dedicate whatever power systems you have just to the scientific instruments, and that conserves a lot of space and a lot of weight.
Yeah, and so there are a lot of potential advantages to inflatable rovers that blow with the wind. Number one, yeah, like you were saying, you don't really need a drive system. You might want to have some kind of internal steering mechanism, but that would, like, you can have a counterweight that yeah. would still take advantage of the wind as the propulsion, but it would be kind of like a rudder on a ship. It
sure.
would be mm-hmm. steering in one direction or another. But then again, when you add that, you'd be adding weight, which would be cutting into what the wind can provide in
sure.
terms of moving
sure.
you. And so one problem this would solve is that it would be very easy to land a vehicle like this. I
yep.
mean, you wouldn't have to worry about it breaking upon impact with the surface. You just drop it down and it set down like a beach ball. So you can just imagine it being blown along on the surface, but not necessarily alone. You could also potentially, I would think, use a system like this in a swarm search strategy.
Sure.
So if you wanted to send a whole bunch of beach balls up to Mars, and they could fan out over the landscape and explore lots of different things, which would give you redundancy as well. If one of them breaks down or gets stuck, it's not such a big deal. If you have a big inflatable beach ball that's exploring Mars, you can set it down. How would you do that? Just partially deflate it.
Yeah.
Take some of the air out of it, and then it sits down, becomes stationary.
Yeah. See, your description of the swarm of these things just makes me think of every concert I went to in the 80s, where just the air would be filled with these things, which just makes me think that we'd really be giving the Martians a great time.
Yeah.
But I think it's cool. They're obviously the biggest disadvantage you could argue is that since you don't ultimately control the direction that this thing can go in, you're very much limited by whatever way the wind happens to be blowing. You're literally...
Right. You're also very limited in terms of the instrumentation you can carry, because it needs to be extremely lightweight in order to work. Like, the Curiosity can take all kinds of arms and machines that,
right.
that do different tests. You would have much fewer options with something like this. You'd have to... really pick what you want to go on there, and you'd have to find a way to make it very small and light.
And furthermore, capable of working within this beach ball capacity. I mean, I'm not sure if you would be able to send a little scooper thing out into the soil
right.
at that point.
You might be able to have some sort of semi-permeable membrane as the beach ball body, and then therefore you could take samples of, like, atmospheric samples, that kind of thing. But then also there's the concern that if the ball encounters something like a valley,
yeah.
for example, and then gets to a point where it can't be blown further. It could get stuck very quickly. That's something that we don't have to worry about with these rovers, where we can actually maneuver them around or out of natural landscapes that would be otherwise impossible to travel through.
Right. I'm picturing just an entire army of these beach ball robots stuck in a single trench on Mars. And
just there'd be a cartoon of a Martian walking by saying, "Who the hell did this?"
Well, I want to talk about another spherical design.
Okay.
Please do.
So this other one, I also talked about this in my blog post about these. It's the Joelbot.
So this was the one that could actually jump, right?
Yeah, so it's still spherical. This was designed, by the way, in 2008 by a PhD student named Rodri R. Moore from the University of Bath. And so imagine sort of a spherical cage.
Right.
It's just an outline.
Right. So, yeah, think of your beach ball where you have the seams.
It's just like a skeleton of a beach ball.
Right. There's nothing in between those seams. It's just those are bands that form a ball-like shape.
So, right. So you're not going to have the same breeze-driven technology that that beach ball example would. But if you get tension into those cage arms, you can allow it to roll purposefully and also hop.
Yeah. So imagine through the middle of this spherical cage, you've got a rod that can compress like a spring. And then once you compress it far enough, it builds up potential energy to release suddenly and do a hopping action like a grasshopper. And so that could come in really handy, you could imagine, if it were to get stuck or if it were to need to get over an obstacle.
Yeah, there's something about this particular design that bothers me, but I'm going to save that because it actually applies to another robot on our list, and that way I can just cover them all at once.
Okay. There is something that I think is really cool. This is probably what you're talking about here, which is the robot based on the tensegrity architecture.
Yeah.
It's called the Super Ball Bot, and it has been under active research at NASA's Innovative Advanced Concepts Program. That's the NIAC.
It's like
Brainiac without the Bray.
That's true. So
I'll call it Brainiac from now on.
So this isn't Superman's enemy. It would just be man's enemy by that logic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it'd be your man's enemy.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So it's under the direction of a couple guys named Vitas Sunspiral. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Sunspiral does seem to be the way it's spelled.
And Adrian Egogino. It's based on this tensegrity architecture. So imagine it's a roughly spherical shape, very roughly. Instead of seeing a spherical skin or a spherical cage, imagine you're looking at like a tangle of Christmas lights, except not really. It's more like poles and cables.
Right.
So you've got these rods and then you've got these strings coming out the ends of them. And just staring at it sitting on the ground, it might look like some collapsed mess of just knotted up components. But once it starts to move, you realize that these cables connecting the ends of the rods can relax and contract, kind of like the muscles that control your skeleton.
Very much so.
Yeah. And so what this thing can do is it can, by this contracting and relaxing action, move itself along on the ground. It can cause itself to tumble forward on the landscape.
It can also raise itself up a little bit by creating that tension. So, you know, it's just imagine any kind of structure that relies on cables and rods, like a tent. That's an easy one to imagine. It's using tension to maintain that stability. And really saying it's like our muscles and bones is pretty accurate. If you think about it, like when I tried to describe this to someone, I said, all right, well, just imagine you have a mass of bones and muscle tissue that's all attached together and it's still able to relax and contract and move around that way. And they said, that's awful. I'm like, well, you need to watch these videos because even when they tend to be really sped up, the videos are sped up quite a bit because this thing moves very slowly.
Otherwise,
right now,
they're still
learning to program its motion.
Sure.
And the way they're learning to program its motion, I think, is really cool. They're using an evolutionary simulator.
Mm-hmm.
So they're basically pitting control schemes against each other in a survival of the fittest simulated by the computer.
And whichever one ends up coming out on top is the one they go with.
So a system like this can absorb shock, and that's one big advantage. You can drop it on the surface of the planet without really worrying that it's going to break. Like if you just were to drop a rover on Mars that had wheels, I'm sure it would just shatter
an
all
axle
over the place.
Could, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it absorbs shock, and it can fold up for transport. This is a really interesting thing. It can just kind of like fold itself into a neat little triangle. And can be deployed easily that way. It's lightweight, it's structurally robust, and it is capable of some very versatile motion, potentially, depending on how they manage the control scheme.
Yeah, the thing that concerns me, and this was the other one that made me think about my concern. So for both this one and our CageBot friend, the issue I have is that I can imagine a system like this getting hung up on protrusions. So think of a really rocky surface and this thing's trying to get through. Like if you've ever worn anything that has any loops on it whatsoever, I guarantee at some point you've walked past something and gotten hooked on it. And then you have to stop and you have to dislodge it and continue on your way.
Or you just keep pulling until it rips.
Or you just keep pulling until it rips. If you're Joe and you're just YOLO, you just keep going. But for most of us, we just, you know, it's, I said to Joe earlier before we did the podcast, I said, I'm one of those people who, if I have something that's got loops on it, it's going to catch on something. Probably sooner rather than later. If I were to ever actually attempt to catch something with a loop, I would never, ever do it.
Well, hopefully Murphy's Law would apply less to this robot than it would to you.
One would hope, but I'm thinking about, you know, a really chaotic landscape. You could have a lot of potential for getting, especially you're talking about lots of open space and then cables. So there's a lot of areas where cables could get hooked on things. And I could just imagine that that would end up causing a lot of frustration down the line, not for the robot, it doesn't care, but for the engineers who have
unless we program it to care and feel bad about itself.
Right. Like, why can't you move, stupid? But yeah, I mean, the idea that you would have to waste time and energy to free it from whatever it happened to get caught on, that's the biggest potential problem here, is that this, it has the potential of getting hooked up on lots of different stuff.
I can see that, though I also at the same time think, well, mostly what it would be encountering, I'd imagine, would be like sand and then some rocks. And there might be like some really craggy rocks I can see it getting hung up on. But in general, it's not going to be running into like deer antlers.
Or protruding nails or, yeah.
Yeah, you guys just don't hang out in the right parts of Mars.
Apparently not.
There are antlers.
Yeah, the Antler Valley is not the one that I visit all the time.
It's two valleys over from that one that's filled with all the beach balls.
Is that what you keep getting your loops caught on, Jonathan? Antlers?
No. Oh, antlers. Yeah. No, it does happen more frequently than I care to admit.
All right, guys. Do we have any other examples?
Yes, we do.
Roly-poly robots.
Well, one is something that I can't find in any way has been mentioned with reference to space, so it may be completely not germane. But it's so cool that I just wanted to bring it up as a possibility when we're talking about whole-body rolling robots, like these spherical robots, is the Morphex, which is a transforming hexapod robot built by a Norwegian guy named Kari Halvorsen.
Yep. So this one's a really cool one. It looks like when it's completely all the limbs are pulled in, it looks like a ball.
Yeah.
Yeah. It looks like kind of a semi opaque whitish ball. And then things start moving.
Yeah. It's a spherical hybrid robot with 12 curved triangular panels. So imagine a globe.
Right.
And then draw lines through it, separating it into six curved triangles on top and six curved triangles on the bottom.
Okay.
Slices of pie in a way.
Now imagine these little slices of pie can unfurl and turn into
legs.
Fold out and turn into legs like little crab legs.
So this is a robotic D12? That's okay.
Kind of, except it doesn't have flat surfaces. It's actually round on the outside.
Okay.
So it's more like a D100, if you've ever seen one of those, you know? Not the D10s.
I have.
Okay. It really saves you time when you have to roll percentages. I'm just saying. So this robot has a couple of different ways of creating locomotion. One is that it can unfold its legs, and it does end up having six legs. That way, the top six panels remain kind of closed in, although they can open up a little bit too. But the bottom six panels open up to be legs, and then it moves around kind of like a crab.
Yeah,
like it's very
looks
crab-like.
Like a plastic crab.
This sounds amazing and creepy.
Now, if it folds up into a ball, it can actually just flex the legs a little bit, pushing the panels outward and thus rolling the ball forward. So it can either roll or crawl.
And so what this actually reminded me of was one of the actual rovers we talked about earlier, Athlete, which combined the leg action and the rolling action.
Yeah, except in that case, it was wheels on the end of legs.
Right. This would be a combination of climbing leg abilities with whole body rolling abilities.
Yeah. So you could easily imagine like using something like this to climb up a hill, for example, to get a look around the hill and see where does it want to go from there, and then doing a controlled roll down the other side of the hill, because that would be far more efficient than climbing back down.
Right.
You know, it's not something, again, like Joe was saying, it's not something that is specifically being hailed as the future in rover robotics, but it's something that sparked our imagination.
Yeah, well, we're just saying, space people, take a look at this thing.
get a load of this thing over here. It's pretty interesting and slightly less terrifying than Athlete was.
Well,
I think Athlete is perfectly cuddly.
Do you?
I would wrap my arms around one of those legs.
We're going to make you watch the Return to Oz the sequence with the wheelies in a minute, and then, you know, or wheelers, I guess is what they're called.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, those are scary.
Really right. Not okay.
Well, anyway, that's generally the types of locomotion that we wanted to look at. There are other options as well. In fact, I've seen some interesting robotics that end up emulating the movements of snakes.
Oh, or fish.
Yeah. So there are definitely other means of locomotion, but these are the ones we think are probably the most likely. In fact, I think I'll be amazed if anything overtakes the wheel anytime really soon. But it's fun to kind of stretch our minds in this way. And if we ever get to a point where some of these considerations are no longer as important, things like you have to worry about how much power the locomotion is going to consume, then who knows? I mean, then you really open up the door. Now, I don't see that changing anytime in the near future, but it's also a possibility. So, like Joe said at the very top of this podcast, this is just scratching the surface, even of robotic locomotion. And then there are all those other elements that are related back to that DARPA challenge I mentioned at the very beginning that we could go on and on about. And we'll probably do more episodes about some of the big problems in robotics today and how people are going about addressing that and meeting those challenges. I think there's plenty of opportunity to talk about that. But if there's something about the future you want to hear about specifically, and maybe it has nothing to do with robots at all, let us know. Send us a message. Our email address is fwthinking@discovery.com, or drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Google+. You can find us with the handle fwthinking at all three. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Fedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.